From the newsroom of PCJ Radio International, this is Focus Asia Pacific. I'm Keith Perron. The Cook Islands police have apologized for poor communication during the double murder and shootout on Ratunga last week. Mary Dean and her partner were killed by her former partner, Chris Miatul, last Thursday after he escaped a prison guard while on community release. Mary Dean moved back to Ratunga from New Zealand 7 years ago with her youngest son. Her family says they have still not received official information from police. Alex Perrotte reports.
Mary Dean's cousin, Tapairu Tuakeo Skinner, lives on Rarotonga, but was in Melbourne when she heard news on Facebook about the death. Her family stopped her from coming home immediately, as they couldn't confirm for days that it was safe. She says police didn't even relieve their fears for Mary Dean's 9-year-old son, who police knew was in the care of another family.
I'm very frustrated because the whole process has just been no productive communication or effective communication has been done for 1 week now.
The police commissioner, Mara Tetava, was directing the police operation. Although he had two senior officers at the base, he says he takes full responsibility.
As leader of the police service here, it's my fault that we didn't get to the public as quickly as we could. But my top priority and the top priority of my team was to get to this person as quickly as we could. I had two commanders, very senior officers back at my command centre, and they were in charge of that. And as I say, if we didn't get to the public as quickly as we should, my fault. I apologise for that.
Ms. Tuakeo Skinner says police did not allow the next of kin to identify Ms. Dean's body, but chose a work colleague instead. RNZ's correspondent in Rarotonga, Flo Syme Buchanan, says if police are sorry, they should now be actively engaging the family, but it's clear they are not.
The contact with the family and communication with the family is of utmost importance, and police should have appointed by now a liaison officer to, you know, for the family.
Ms. Tuakeo Skinner says they are now looking at other avenues to get information.
There's been no consistency right from the start. They've just pushed me to the limit, and I have initiated an independent investigation.
That investigator is former New Zealand Detective Inspector Mark Franklin. Flo Syme Buchanan says he told her he's also concerned about the way police stormed the house where Rimamoto was holed up.
The standard procedure is to wait the situation out, but instead the Commissioner of Police with four other police officers stormed the building, kicked down the door of the house. Shots were fired by the gunman. Fortunately and miraculously, no one was shot, and the police weren't even wearing bulletproof vests.
Mara Tetava says his men don't have bulletproof vests and he simply worked with what he had. He defended the police operation, which he says was a success.
We've never had this kind of thing happen before. I've been in the police service now for 31 years, and this was the first time I've had to take my firearm out for an incident such as this. And that shows how we've taken for granted how peaceful our place is.
Mara Tetava says there will be a full police investigation. Rimamoto was able to escape a prison guard who took him out on community release to fetch tools from his shipping container. He took a gun from the container and made his way to a house where Mary Dean and her partner, Roger Taurarea, stayed, firing multiple shots at both of them. The family say they want the prison guard stood down. The Justice Minister, Nandi Glassie, defended the police actions but says errors were made by prison staff. Following the coroner's report and an autopsy, Mary Dean's body will be returned to Tokoroa in New Zealand for burial next to the graves of her parents. This is Alex Perrottet.
A former Papua New Guinea cabinet minister says Port Moresby has to do more to help prepare Bougainville for its referendum on independence. The autonomous region is set to hold a vote in June 2019. A former MP for Central Bougainville and the first minister of Bougainville Affairs, Sam Akula, says the national government must do everything possible to ensure Bougainvillians have full faith in the autonomous Bougainville government, or ABG, ahead of the vote, which is in its final stages of the peace agreement. He said he has prepared a statement for the National Parliament's bipartisan committee, which met last week on Bougainville, and hopes that MPs will get a better idea of the issues facing Bougainville ahead of the vote. He told Don Wiseman about his chief concerns.
The issue that I was basically highlighting to the parliamentary committee is that Bougainville is an autonomous region, and Bougainville must not be treated as one of the provinces in Papua New Guinea, but respect the arrangements which are set out in the Bougainville Peace Agreement and also the constitutional arrangements which bond the ABG. And that has been my concern, that in some instances, the national government has basically not treated Bougainville government as an autonomous government for the people of Bougainville.
I mean, you see it as dragging its feet on a number of issues like the funding and so on.
My concern is that these arrangements for funding are guaranteed under the Papua New Guinea Constitution. And those are constitutional grants and also grants which are catered for in the Bougainville Peace Agreement. And for the purposes of restoring total peace in Bougainville, which is the objective of the Bougainville Peace Agreement, Mr. Gamman, it's not making funds available to Bougainville, then that will be seen as national government contributing towards not restoring peace in Bougainville.
In your statement, you talked about the impact of the Rio Tinto divestment of shares and how Port Moresby handed its shares.
That was one of many issues that I raised as an example, that the national government is trying to deal with directly with a fraction of Bougainvillians in relation to issues in Bougainville. And my concern is that any issues that must be addressed in Bougainville must be addressed through ABD and no other means to try and address issues in Bougainville. The Rio Tinto issue is an issue that I have a lot of concern about. My concern is that accepting the 17%, basically landowners or even ABD accepting it, would be seen as accepting the liabilities as well, the past and the present liabilities, which people of Bougainville have been raising with Rio Tinto before the crisis and during the crisis.
What you're saying is that there hasn't been respect shown by the national government for the ABG. I think you were the very first Minister of Bougainville Affairs, weren't you, back in the late 90s? So this must make you feel very angry that this is happening as a Bougainvillean yourself, but yet someone who's been near the top of the national government, that the current national government's behaving the way it is.
Now, my frustration is that it took us many, many hours and resources to end up with the Bougainville Peace Agreement. And Bougainville has actually lost a lot of lives on Bougainville during the crisis. What seems to be happening is that people seem to not remember that there was a conflict in Bougainville, which took many lives. What I would like to see ABG and national government is to fully engage in addressing the issues which are supposed to be completed before referendum.
The national broadcaster in Fiji has been reported to police after widespread public criticism of what is being described as racist and inflammatory content on one of its television programs. The host of the FBC TV's Wasi Basha language program was widely criticized for perceived negative racial stereotyping of indigenous Fijians. While he has apologized profusely, the media regulatory has been silent, and the opposition says the CEO of FBC should resign. Kurori Hawkins has more.
At the center of the controversy is a selection of supposedly everyday phrases, which were translated in English, Fijian and Hindi. They were being taught on the Wasea Basa TV program, whose two-part name in Fijian and Hindi translates sharing language. The choice of phrases has led to complaints by many, including Peter Wangabonovono.
It's really insulting stuff, like, for example, indigenous Fijians, they can't excel in university or tertiary education because they play too much sports. Indigenous Fijians have a problem in reading English.
Peter Wangabonovono is among youth and advocacy group leaders who filed a formal complaint with the Media Industry Development Authority, and he has filed a complaint with the police.
This is definitely not the kind of tenor that we expect from a national broadcasting corporation that is funded by our taxpayers' money. So for as a taxpayer, also as an indigenous Fijian, it would be a mess for me not to even complain about this particular incident.
This complaint was filed despite the program's producer, Nemani Bainivalu, issuing apologies in Fijian, Hindi and English on social media and on TV.
The fact that examples within the lessons that I have has hurt some of you is sincerely regretted, and I take full responsibility for this and assure you that this will not be repeated. In hindsight, this was a lax oversight on my part and was sincerely not intended to cause anyone any offence.
The chair of Fiji's Media Industry Development Authority, Ashwin Raj, was overseas and numerous attempts to get a statement from his office were unsuccessful. One of the complainants, Vani Vulada of the Boer Urban Youth Network, said she wanted to know why the MIDA chair, Ashwin Raj, said he would wait for an official complaint from the public before investigating the FBC. She said this was particularly concerning because of the public outcry over the program on social media and the clear mandate MIDA has to investigate cases on its own initiative.
People get angered when they see the rules being applied sparingly, you know, to a certain group of society. So it's really about equality. It really is about, you know, making sure that people understand that, you know, laws apply to everyone.
The FBC's chief executive, Riaz Syed Kayum, who is currently out of the country, has been quoted in local media as saying any suggestion of incitement is not correct. However, the opposition says he should resign. The opposition leader, Rote Mumukepa, says three MPs have been suspended over similar incidents and senior Fiji Times staff face possible jail terms after being charged with inciting communal antagonism. She says the apology is of no consequence and Mr. Syed Kayum should go.
So we would like him to take responsibility for what has happened with one of their stations. And in this regard, he should do the honourable thing.
It is no longer possible to access the content on Wasir Basa's YouTube channel, which previously had more than 70 videos, including past episodes of the TV programme. This is Kuroi Hawkins.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. When it comes to gay, lesbian, bi, and transgender issues, Asia is usually not the first region that comes to mind. But within that region is a small island called Taiwan. Over the last 10 years or more, Taiwan has actually made great strides in increasing the knowledge of the community, awareness, and also rights. This weekend, Taipei is hosting its annual Pride Parade, which only started with, well, about 300 people, which has now grown to more than 65,000. Tiffany Tai is with the organizer, and we talked about that and other issues about gay and lesbian, bisexual, transgender rights in Taiwan.
I think LGBT acceptance is accelerating in Asia, especially in Taiwan, which is considered the most LGBT-friendly country in Asia. And recently, there are more and more visibility in LGBT communities, especially I think the founding of the first and only LGBTQ film festival in Taiwan helped a lot, Taiwan International Queer Film Festival, and they are generating a lot of media buzz. For example, they founded the first LGBT awards called the first Queer Mosa Awards that's happening on Friday, one day before LGBT Pride Parade. So I think that's definitely one thing that helped accelerated LGBT acceptance in Taiwan.
Now you're saying, of course, the acceptance has gathered momentum. But in Taiwan, for example, are you starting to see the same kind of thing, let's say, that you would see in Europe or Canada, the US or Australia, where you'll have companies, let's say, like IKEA, that would specifically target the GLBT community?
Yes, many international companies in Taiwan are acting like the way they do globally, like Google, like Facebook, like Nike, Microsoft has always been very LGBTQ friendly. And JP Morgan, who is one of our sponsors of the film festival this year. And also you see that in local companies in Taiwan as well. One of our sponsors is a local cafe called Crown, and also there's a very famous campaign for this wedding cookies, Isabel, in Taiwan as well. So you definitely see that in local companies and international corporations in Taiwan.
Now, in Taiwan, many people outside Taiwan, of course, would consider it a very conservative and traditional society. How has it been able to get to the point where it is now, because of the traditional and say cultural values?
Perception has changed a lot throughout years. It's definitely a generation issue. And I talked to a politician who campaigned throughout Taiwan, and she even went to the rural areas in Taiwan and talked to a lot of people. And she said the reception has been warm and very welcoming. So I think that's changing throughout Taiwan as a kind of like as time change. People don't care about it anymore. It was just not brought up. And I think the perception of Taiwan being a conservative society is a little outdated.
Mm-hmm. But have there been, for example, any protests from religious organizations in Taiwan over this?
Yes, there has. Mm-hmm. I mean, but you see that throughout the world, even in the U.S., which is considered a very liberal country and a very LGBT country where marriage, same-sex marriage is recently made legal. You see extreme religion groups that protest as well. So, yeah, there are certain religious groups that protest against pride parades and same-sex marriage.
Now, let's talk about the parade itself. It's actually on Saturday, and it actually takes place in Taipei. As it's going on, are there other types of parades taking place in other Taiwanese cities, or is it just Taipei?
There are pride parades in Taipei, Taichung, and Kaohsiung.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely not. In Taipei, it's kind of like an international tourism thing that's happening now. A lot of people put it on their cultural agenda, and people travel from all over Asia to Taipei for the big pride parade. But Taichung, Kaohsiung is a little more local mm-hmm. and smaller in terms of scale.
So what you're saying then is the one in Taipei is really gathering a lot of international attention then compared to the other ones, which are, of course, much smaller cities.
Yes, definitely. People from like mainland China, Hong Kong, Indonesia travel to Taiwan for a weekend and party and go to the pride parade. It's a huge thing in a gay community in Asia.
Let's talk about the gala that's taking place on the Friday before the Pride Parade itself. It's taking place at one of the major hotels located in the Taipei 101 area. If you're not familiar with the Taipei 101 area, it was at one time the tallest building in the world. It's a huge tourism area and business district. And this is not a small hotel. This is one of the big hotels there. What can you tell us about the gala?
It's this first year, and it's taking place at W Taipei. W Taipei has been very generous in giving us this space for a very good price, and they've been very supportive in staff and event organizing. The event itself will have celebrity presenters like Ella from the Supergirl group SHE and other celebrities and in music and film. And we have 10 awards categories, and I can't really tell you about the attendance yet, so we're keeping it a secret. Our founder, which is also the founder of Film Festival, says that media plays a huge role in our society in terms of storyteller, and when it honors this agency with fair and accurate reporting of LGBT stories, we get to reshape our own culture, which is what we're trying to achieve with this gala.
Now, let's talk about the film festival. Is this pretty much the same kind of film festival that you'd find in other countries, or does it have a very different focus? Does it show films only from Taiwan and Asia, or is it films from all around the world?
We've only done the festival in Taiwan,
mm-hmm.
and we've always had a very international programming. This year in particular, we are linking up with Berlinale, the Berlin International Film Festival, mm-hmm. because Jay, the founder and director, was invited to be one of their juries at Teddy Award in Berlinale. So we will be paying tribute to Berlinale 30, celebrating the 30 years of Teddy Award. And we're screening all of their Teddy Award-winning films and some of the nominated films as well. And last year, during the second TIQFF, we put together an Asia-Pacific Queer Film Festival Alliance. So there is a segment of queer shorts from that region. And also, we have one film from Taiwan. Most of it is Berlinale programming this year.
You know, I find this actually rather interesting because when I tell people about what is actually going on here, because of the perception that people have of Taiwan, they kind of get mystified saying, huh, how is that possible? Because that's not the image that they have of a country based in Asia.
I guess Taiwan, when you look at Taiwan in the region, in Asia, it's definitely a gem and it definitely stands out in how liberal, how open-minded it is. But I think people just haven't been to Taiwan.
Do people here in the community in Taiwan see what's happening here as a way to, I'm not going to say influence, or maybe I do mean that, but a way to, let's say, show the direction to, say, other countries in the region, let's say like China?
Yes, definitely. Because last year, as I said, we formed the Asia Pacific Queer Film Festival Alliance, and all the film festival founders and directors got together and talked about how to improve, how to pour resources, how to change the society. And I don't know if this is going to get them into trouble, but the queer film festival directors, organizers have such a harder time, and they have to come up with these creative ways to go around the policies and the censorship when they screen queer content. Mm-hmm. So, for example, one of the film organizers said that a couple of their screenings are actually take place on buses where people have tablets. People get on the bus and they have tablets with the movie screening, and the bus will keep driving. And they compare the LGBT pride there as the LGBT run, because they have to run away from the police and the people who are censoring them. It's more like a marathon instead of a parade. So they do ask us for suggestions and for resources. And because of Taiwan's advantages, we are very willing to share our resources. We share our films, we share our programming and our marketing strategies, and sponsorship strategies with our partners in China.
What kind of support, if there's any, from either the Taipei city government or the central government?
We can apply for funds for filmmakers' travels. So if we want to invite a filmmaker to come from Berlin, to come from the States, we ask for our government's culture bureau to sponsor us in terms of their travels and accommodation.
Is it something that's easy to do, or is it rather complicated, like in other places?
I think it's when you try to get funds from the government, especially if you're in arts and culture, it's usually a lot of red tape, and that's no exception in Taiwan. Yeah, but they have been. There have been efforts to try to accelerate acceptance and help us organize these events.
Right. Tiffany, thanks a lot for talking to us today.
Thank you so much.
A support network for families of seasonal workers at Vanuatu is in high demand as families find themselves without a parent for a big chunk of the year. Ni Vanuatu workers make up the biggest slice of participants in New Zealand's recognized seasonal employer scheme. About 4,000 are in the country. Peter Bumsang, who's in his 11th season in New Zealand under the scheme, set up the Strengthening Seasonal Worker Family Program in Vanuatu with his wife 5 years ago. He told Bridget Turnicliffe, life can be difficult for families when they go back home when one parent, usually the father, is away for months at a time.
The absence of being away from the family, that's the big challenge that all the RSC workers face. I mean, for being here for 6 or 7 months, it's not easy. The other challenge, I think the women, takes time for the family to cope that they know that the husbands are away. I think another issue is for the women to well organize, to look after the kids while the men are away.
So you set up a program about 5 years ago, and tell me about that.
I've seen the impact of the RSC, that it has bring a big impact to the families and communities. So the idea of starting the program, I think, is to protect the scheme, and to protect it, we have to find ways of trying to make the families well organized as well. I think the whole idea of starting the program is to protect the scheme, because it's just my own point of view. I've seen that the scheme has really helped the families and the communities back home. So we decide to start a program to look after the families, the women and the kids while they're back home in Vanuatu, while the husbands are working in New Zealand. Because I've realized that when the men know that the families are well looked after, the family are okay, the men perform well in the work that they're doing here in New Zealand.
What kind of activities have you organized through the program?
We had social activities, educational activities, and spiritual activities.
So is it beneficial for example, the wives that are left behind? Before, did they feel a little bit isolated?
Yes, that's what they feel in the first place. I mean, they feel a bit isolated because sometimes they struggle, you know, to send the kids to school or to organize things back in their home so that the kids are well organized to go to school and so on. So we try to make them involved in some of these activities to make them feel that someone cares about them.
Is there demand for other things from the program? Are you wanting to offer other things in the future?
Now we're looking how to improve, and I think to make it better. The issue we're having is with the financing, the program, and make it bigger, because now the number is increasing.
And with that, we conclude this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. If you'd like to let us know what you think of the program, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is very simple. It's focus@pcjmedia.com. Once again, focus@pcjmedia.com. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you all things. So long, take care. We'll see you again very soon. Bye-bye.